Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I'm happy to speak with you this evening about artificial intelligence from a Thomistic perspective. Part of this will be geared more toward Thomistic philosophy, Thomas's conversation with Aristotle, and then how Thomas brings that into his reading of Gospel, the Gospel of John. So we're going to cover a little bit of philosophical and theological area today. And I've saved time at the end for questions because as artificial intelligence is an emerging field, I'm interested to hear what you have to say, especially from the different perspectives of what you study. But we're going to begin in May of 1997 when world chess champion Garry Kasparov traveled to New York City to play a six-game match with Deep Blue, a supercomputer developed by IBM designed to beat world-class chess players. This was their second meeting. Kasparov, whom some consider the best chess player of all time, had won handily against Deep Blue in a tournament in Philadelphia the year prior. But he had proposed a rematch, and Deep Blue's programmers had been hard at work. Its new generation of hardware was twice as fast, and it could search 200 million chess positions per second to a depth of 6 to 8 pairs of moves. Kasparov became, according to his own words, the man in the proverbial man versus machine competition. In New York, he won the first game, Deep Blue the second. The next three games ended in a draw, and going into the sixth game, Kasparov was under tremendous stress, according to Deep Blue's developer, who said that he wasn't mentally prepared. Kasparov resigned the sixth game after 19 moves. He threw his hands up and walked away from the table. Thus, Deep Blue became the first computer program to defeat a world champion in a chess match under tournament regulations. People watching around the world couldn't believe what they had seen, and the story exploded across the media. The human brain had lost the match that Newsweek called the brain's last stand. It's extremely dramatic. But I remember this. I remember in the newspaper seeing a photo of Kasparov with his head in his hands, having capitulated to the computer. In a TED Talk from 2017, Kasparov recalls his first impression of playing against Deep Blue. He said, "I sat down and I immediately sensed something new, something unsettling." The same can be said today for anyone who has interacted with text generative AI of the caliber of ChatGPT. There's something new and unsettling about its facility with human conversation. It can respond to prompts in a way no artificial intelligence before it did. There is an eerie similarity between the speech of ChatGPT and the speech of a human person. It has passed the Turing test, a test that measures natural language comprehension. In other words, can you talk like a human being? GPT-4, available for purchase, can pass almost every major standardized test with flying colors. And as I put together this talk, it's difficult to even keep up with the developments. The latest news is that GPT is going to have a desktop app on the Mac, which allows you to ask the bot questions about what's on your screen. And OpenAI is slowly rolling out GPT-4o, which processes information faster, with one author claiming that it understands speech, emotion, and human interaction natively without turning it into text first. So there seems to be endless potential for this newer, faster, more sophisticated models of text generative AI. And in some sectors, this powerful tool has been met with great enthusiasm, in others with skepticism and concern. And it's a hot topic in higher education. Maybe students meet it with great enthusiasm, but professors meet it with skepticism and concern. I don't know. Is ChatGPT a useful tool for authentic learning, or is it a threat? Can it aid human communication or hinder it? And will it eventually surpass human speech and human intelligence in ways that we have not yet anticipated? Fortunately, we have a theologian and philosopher on hand, Thomas Aquinas, who can help us understand human intelligence and particularly that expression of human intelligence called speech. His 13th century insights have much to offer us as we grapple with the promises and perils of ChatGPT. And so in this talk, what I'd like to do is compare the speech of ChatGPT with human speech as Aquinas sees it. And I'll show that while ChatGPT output does resemble human speech, perhaps more so than any other non-human device, the process by which it speaks is different in very important ways from the process of human articulation. This we may know intuitively, and so we're going to spell this out through Thomas's worldview. Okay? My hope is that this basic comparison allows us to further ponder the role of ChatGPT in human life, especially at the university. So I have a first section, a brief section on how ChatGPT works. And the disclaimer is that I'm not super technically inclined. I'm kind of one of those people that still messes it up when I have to tap my card at the card reader thing. But I've done some research, and this is sort of the best explanation I can put forward for how this works, okay? ChatGPT is a large language model chatbot developed by the company OpenAI. It's the fastest growing consumer application in history. So the first iteration was announced in 2018, just 6 years ago. And today it has 180 million monthly users. And GPT stands for Generative Pre-trained Transformer. Generative because it belongs to a class of artificial intelligence called generative AI, which uses models or algorithms to produce new output based on previously digested material. Pre-trained because it has been trained on massive amounts of data, 570 gigabytes of data, consisting of internet text and digitized books. And this amounts to several billion human written web pages with trillions of words and text and over 500 million digitized books. Certainly more than one person could ever read. Although its knowledge cutoff right now is September of 2021. So GPT can produce a sequence of words that best responds to the prompt that you give it. And its training has also been fine-tuned by humans with a process called alignment, which ensures that artificial intelligence performs consistently and aligns with certain human criteria and values, such as helpfulness, truthfulness, and harmlessness. This means that human feedback has reinforced certain connections in its neural network that align with these criteria. Okay. If you don't do this, you tend to have AI that can stray in a certain direction, like a really racist chatbot or something like that. So you kind of have to rein it in with this process. T, transformer, refers to attention transformer, which is the neural network architecture ChatGPT uses to process data. Neural networks themselves have been long used to predict the next words in a sentence to varying degrees of success. But ChatGPT's transformer is capable of self-attention, meaning that the bot can process every word in a sentence at once versus just from left to right, select the most relevant words, and consider them in relation to all the other words in a sentence. It does this by tokenizing words, encoding them as numerical representations for the neural network to process. The tokens are related to one another in an enormous matrix. We might think of it as a very sophisticated multidimensional concept map. Science educator Kyle Hill says ChatGPT can represent the relationships between words not in two-dimensional or three-dimensional space, but in 12,288-dimensional space. Finally, there's an element of randomness programmed into GPT's responses called temperature, which ensures that it doesn't respond to the same prompt the same way every time. And this is another feature that makes it seem authentically and perhaps even scarily human. To sum up this section, text input from humans becomes numbers. Those numbers prompt ChatGPT to generate the most likely numbers that would come next in the sequence, with some control for values and randomness. And then those numbers are decoded into words for the human reader. Here's a great example. You know, if you've interacted with ChatGPT at all, I think you understand this. But just in case you haven't, Ari Shulman of The New Atlantis fed it this question, a text message that he didn't understand with an error in it. And he said, well, what is my friend mean I'm beating up with my brother? And GPT says, recognizes the typo, and then corrects it and interprets it for him. Okay, so this level of sophistication is really new. But does ChatGPT really understand or grasp the words it produces? Many say no. Ian Bogost of The Atlantic says it lacks the ability to truly understand the complexity of human language. Harry Guinness at Zapier says that he uses the terms understanding and comprehending in an analogical sense. He says, these are simply the most useful words we have for describing how AIs operate. GPT doesn't truly understand English. I think Thomas Aquinas would agree with this. So let's now turn to his thought. How do we speak according to Aquinas? How did I write this talk? How do I find the words to tell someone that I love them? How did my five-year-old come up with two very silly hypothetical instruments to add to an orchestra, a blogo and a fukistrophe? And why does he chase me around the house, making the sounds that he thinks these instruments will make? It is probably no surprise to you that Thomas approaches this question differently than we would through something like neuroscience or educational psychology. And it's not the goal of my presentation to explain how his account agrees or doesn't with these contemporary disciplines, although this is a valuable question, and I can provide some resources to pursue it at the end of the talk. Here, I'll simply outline Aquinas' understanding of the mechanics of human speech. Even though he doesn't have a full-blown theory of language, this idea is very important to his theological and philosophical work. He draws his thoughts on human speech from two sources. The first is Greek philosophy, specifically Aristotle. Aquinas wrote commentaries on Aristotle's On the Soul and On Interpretation. And these are important sources for him because in them, Aristotle explains the human mind and how speech is formed and why. The second of these sources is Christian tradition, especially the claim that the second person of the Trinity, the Son, is the Word of God, in Greek, the Logos. So to do a quick review of the Trinity, in Christian tradition, God is one but exists in a relationship of three persons, Father, Son, and Spirit. And Christians call the second person of the Trinity the Son, and another word for this person of the Trinity is Word. Okay. One of the most important places Aquinas considers the Word is in the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 18, called the Johannine Prologue. If you were a student in Aquinas' class at the University of Paris in the 1270s, you would have spent 11 class days just on these verses. So there are two phrases that are important for our purposes. First is this very first verse, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God." Aquinas understood this to refer to the Word's divinity and eternal existence with God the Father. And then second, in verse 14, "And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us." This refers to the incarnation of Jesus Christ, an event in which the second person of the Trinity, the Word, took on a human nature and became fully human in addition to being fully God. Some of Thomas's richest reflections on human speech come from his interpretation of the Johannine Prologue, and I will work mostly from this text today, but I want to underscore that we are not only working with Thomas's theological claims, rather, we are examining how he draws on Aristotelian tradition, which was much more widespread, right? And to a certain degree, how Thomas makes sense of Scripture through Aristotle's account of human language. So first, let's sketch briefly our own definition of word and think about it from our perspective. We could say something like this, maybe. A word is a thing that you say or write that expresses what you think. Words sometimes accurately express reality, and sometimes they don't. I walked into the garage the other day, and my two-year-old George, he was holding a broom. And I said, "What are you doing, George?" And he said, "I'm raking leaves with my shovel." George's words did not accurately express reality. And even if a word seems accurate to the speaker, it can sometimes be taken in the wrong way by the hearer. For example, when my five-year-old said, "Mom, your dissertation is garbage." Offensive, maybe, but it might have been a compliment because he really loves garbage trucks. Thomas would agree with this definition of word, but he would find it incomplete, and he would say that we need to go from the spoken word to our mind and what's going on first in our minds. So, what is the spoken word? The spoken word is an expression of a concept. Aquinas says that spoken words express what's going on in our minds. Specifically, spoken words consist of the sound of the word and the signification of that sound. Here's Aquinas' commentary on Aristotle's work on interpretation. He says, according to the philosopher, Aristotle, vocal sound signifies the concept of the intellect. The vocal sound which has no signification cannot be called a word. Wherefore, the exterior vocal sound is called a word from the fact that it signifies the interior concept of the mind. Therefore, it follows that first and chiefly, the interior concept of the mind is called a word. Secondarily, the vocal sound itself, signifying the interior concept, is so called. A couple important things come to light here. First, spoken words are only called words properly if they are a sign of a concept in the intellect. Sorry, parrots. For Thomas, you're not speaking, you're just imitating sounds. Or, no matter how much the screaming goats scream, they will never truly reproduce Whitney Houston's ballad, I Will Always Love You. Is that too old of a reference? Google it. Screaming goats, I Will Always Love You. Second, it is the concept or interior word that is primarily and properly called word. In Latin, this is verbum. In Greek, as we saw, it's logos. Okay? And in an Aristotelian Thomistic tradition, the logos refers to a couple things. It refers to the use of reason in discourse, be logical, right? And to how speech is organized. But it also refers to the eternal organizing principle of the cosmos, the reason behind why anything exists at all, and why things exist in the manner that they do. And this is not a uniquely Christian perspective. A lot of ancient cultures shared this idea of some kind of architect or word behind creation. You find this in some Eastern cultures. Hellenic Judaism had it, somebody like Philo. Stoicism had this notion as well. Okay, so Aquinas is picking up on this ancient idea. Okay. And from this perspective, it makes sense that the spoken word cannot be considered the primary word, because to give primacy to spoken words rather than to concepts would be tantamount to saying that created things are superior to their creator. And we can see, too, in a certain natural sense, that the word we say exists first as the thing we mean to say. And this is why we hold people responsible for the things they say. Written words are even further from being words properly speaking, because they are signs of spoken words. So you have the sign of a thing and the sign of a sign. Aquinas, following Aristotle, distinguishes the signification of vocal sounds, which is immediate to the concepts of the intellect, from the signification of written signs, which is more remote. So, words on a page are the sign of a sign. And according to Aristotle, the study of the letter belongs to grammar properly, not to logic. Okay, so to sum up this first part, we've said that a written word signifies a spoken word. And a spoken word is only called a word because it points to this concept in the intellect, the interior word. Okay, this is what Aristotle and Aquinas claim is the primary meaning of word or logos. So the second question is, where do concepts come from? How are they generated? And Aquinas will say, following Aristotle, that a concept comes about through the operation of the intellect. The intellect generates concepts when it understands something. This is an important point that distinguishes Aquinas from many contemporary neuroscientists and philosophers. For Aristotle and Aquinas argued that the human person has a rational soul, which is not material. Okay? And the power of this soul brings about understanding. This isn't Descartes' idea of a soul, a kind of ghost in the machine separable from the body and its functions. For Aquinas, the soul is the form of the body, or the animating, enlivening principle of the body. It's not a part of the body. It's not a material that intervenes in bodily processes, and it's not a principle of movement that competes with neurological, biological, chemical, or other features of movement in the body. Okay? To say that a human person has a soul for Aquinas is essentially the same thing as to say the human person is alive. And because of this, for Aquinas, a concept in the intellect consists of more than what can be measured by one's brain waves. The intellect is this passive power of the soul to know the truth. Through its immateriality, it has the power of intelligence, understanding, intelligendum. Okay? The intellect's freedom from materiality is what allows me to engage in discursive reason, to think abstractly about concepts like love and justice, and to grasp the forms of things. In other words, I can think about triangles, not just this particular triangles. I'm able to abstract the idea of triangles from these different material objects that I see. If the intellect relied completely on material processes, this process of abstraction would not be possible. Specifically, what happens, Aquinas says, is that you receive information from the world. So I have a little diagram, and if you've taken Philosophy 101, you know, you may be familiar with this idea of knowledge. You receive information from the world, either from your external senses or from your internal senses, like your imagination, okay? And it is impressed upon your intellect as the form of a thing. For example, there's a dog running around in front of me in the park. The attributes of that particular dog, fur color, sound of the bark, length of the tail, come to me through my senses. My intellect receives that, but abstracts it and receives the impression of dogness, the form of dog. This is why I can recognize many kinds of dogs, black, white, brown, spotted dogs. I then move to understand that this is a dog. I formulate an interior word or concept of a dog in my intellect. That's a dog, could be my interior word. This is different than simply receiving the form of a dog for Aquinas, because that's done passively. The formation of the concept indicates that my intellect is acting, moving to understand what has been impressed upon it. Then I want to talk about the dog. This is where the exterior word comes in, a kind of manifestation of my interior word. I can turn to the person I'm with and say something like, "Look at that dog." Aquinas says this about the intellect and its operations in the Commentary on John. This is kind of a summary of what I've described to you. He says, there are three things in the intellect: the intellectual power itself, the species or form of the thing understood, and thirdly, the very activity of the intellect, which is to understand. The one who understands forms an interior word when understanding. Okay, let's go and just review this with some takeaways. Okay, first, let's reiterate the important distinctions between the AI chatbot and human words. Human speech begins in the intellect at a level that transcends the material world and works with but is not equal to things like brain activity. Okay, a concept or interior word formed in the intellect indicates that I understand something. This concept gives meaning to the words I speak and write. It is only in this final step, in the spoken or written word, that human speech becomes anything like what ChatGPT digests and produces. ChatGPT's speech begins due to a prompt, which begins a sequence of encoding, processing, and decoding. So yes, it's generative, but it's not creative, like the human intellect. As Kyle Hill says, if you're not asking it a question, nothing is going on inside. Okay, so from an Aristotelian and Thomistic perspective, ChatGPT does not understand the words that it produces. We can only say that it reasons or understands analogically. We can't say that the bot really speaks or writes, unless by that we mean that in its operation it resembles those human activities. Kind of like when we use the language of neural networks. Those imitate but do not actually consist of neurons. Second, let's consider some epistemological and ethical issues that this brings up, especially as it relates to academic life. So first, is using ChatGPT intellectually dishonest? Here's what the University of Oregon's academic code says. Presenting another material as one's own, including using another's words, results, processes, or ideas in whole or in part without giving appropriate credit is plagiarism. And it includes ChatGPT here. So the question of whether ChatGPT is sort of good old-fashioned plagiarism is a topic that I don't pretend to have a definitive answer to. But I think it's important to reflect here. As a student, and admittedly even as a professor, it is extremely tempting to draw on text produced by a chatbot, especially for the more cursory or uninteresting aspects of a paper. I'm not a specialist in AI, and producing the first part of this talk, frankly, was excruciating. Wouldn't it be faster if I could ask a bot to give me the basics of ChatGPT so that I could move on to the really important stuff, to Thomas? Am I really missing something if I skip those hours of scrolling through articles and watching YouTube videos at 1.5 times speed so I can craft 1,000 of my very own words about a subject everybody is already talking about? We could ask similar questions about a lot of college paper topics. Papers produced in undergraduate courses are hardly groundbreaking. Sorry. And we know that part of the academic life is learning how to move efficiently through tremendous amounts of information and then synthesize it. And some claim that ChatGPT is a good tool for this. But based on Thomas's account of speech, copying or even slightly rewording a chatbot's output prevents us from going through the process of forming the concepts ourselves. And that's the signal to us that understanding has taken place, that the intellect is working. So anytime I adopt its text, I run the risk of not really understanding the words I'm using. And isn't this ultimately what intellectual dishonesty is? The theft of someone else's thinking, of their hard-fought work to understand. Another question might be, and along these lines, what happens to me when I use ChatGPT? Did you know that Thomas dedicates a question of the Summa to vices opposed to understanding? One of these is called blindness of mind. And this is how he describes it. He compares it to physical blindness. He says, bodily blindness is the absence of physical sight. Blindness of mind is the absence of intellectual sight. One of the principles of intellectual sight that he describes is, quote, an intelligible principle through which someone understands other things. Aquinas doesn't say it here exactly, but that sounds a lot like the soul's power to generate concepts, the activity of the intellect, which is to understand. And this vice of mental blindness comes about in two ways. Sometimes it happens because we deliberately turn away from understanding. We will not to understand. Other times it happens because the mind is busier with things which it loves more than understanding. This is Thomas's words. When I think about my temptation to use ChatGPT for part of this presentation, I can detect these two causes of mental blindness. I don't want to know this much about AI. I don't want to understand it at this level, especially when there are so many better things to do, like read medieval biblical interpretation, or plant my peas, or sleep. A final ethical question. What about using ChatGPT for a process, writing, coding, creating, generating a bibliography? I'm not pretending that the chatbot's text is expressing my own understanding. I'm just using it as a tool for further research. I think this is a really good question, and I've given this talk several times, and I've received pushback, especially from people involved in practical healthcare sciences, for whom access to AI is really critical to delivering fast care. And I'd like to respond to this with an anecdote. In my undergraduate institution, I considered becoming an architecture major, and the program was 5 years long, and students spent the first 3 years of the program drawing and drafting by hand. It was only after they returned from a year of studying classical architecture in Rome that they were trained on computer software. Why spend 3 years avoiding the computer? Because to be an excellent architect requires a sophisticated understanding of three-dimensional structures like buildings. Working with a pen and pencil, measuring by hand, producing a three-dimensional image on a two-dimensional surface gives someone a much deeper grasp of the subject. It makes for a better architect. So why would we rely on a bot when we'll become better scholars or humans by doing our own research, by strengthening the neurological connections that are in our own brain? Maybe the better question here is not whether ChatGPT should be used as a tool, but when it is appropriate to do so, and further, what skills are so essential to our particular work or our particular formation as human beings that we should not surrender them to artificial intelligence. So we have to take one final step in order to fully understand Aquinas on human speech. And this gets us kind of firmly in Christian territory. So for Aquinas, human speech is patterned after the Word of God, the second person of the Trinity. The Word is the foundation or the exemplar of the human ability to think, to generate interior words. So when humans form concepts, they imitate the Word's eternal procession from God the Father. But there are two important differences between the divine word and our interior words, and Aquinas addresses these in his commentary on John. First, the formation of a concept is not immediate or obvious to us like it is to the word. We don't all at once understand everything presented to our intellect. Otherwise, you wouldn't be listening to me anymore. Even if, when it comes to things like talking about rocks, Aquinas says we have to arrive at these concepts by discursive reason. And this is a difficult process. He says, so long as the intellect, in so reasoning, casts about this way and that, the formation of the concept is not yet complete. It is only when it has conceived the notion of the thing perfectly that for the first time it has the notion of the complete thing and a word. But the Word of God does not form concepts this way. It contains all things perfectly in itself. The Word is the perfect notion of every existing thing because it is the creator of all things. Second, our words are imperfect, but the divine Word is perfect. Aquinas has this to say, since we cannot express all our conceptions in one word, we must form many imperfect words through which we separately express all that is in our knowledge. But it is not that way with God, for since he understands both himself and everything else through his essence, by one act, the single divine word is expressive of all that is in God, not only of the persons, but also of creatures. In this section of the commentary on John, Aquinas is mostly concerned with demonstrating what John means by capital W word. But the way he brings human speech in as a contrast is instructive. Speech is hard. In the Summa, Thomas says there is a twofold obstacle to human speech. The first is the will. We have to want to say something. The second is the body, the actual formation of the words. But here in the commentary, Aquinas provides further insight into the difficulty of speaking. Our reasoning casts about this way and that, forming incomplete, imperfect, interior words. And we may not fully communicate what we understand. Or perhaps it's that we don't yet really understand it. Have you ever found yourself saying, I know what I want to say, I'm just not exactly sure how to say it? This means that you have an incomplete understanding of something. Your interior word is still in formation. Aquinas struggled with this too. He understood the fraught nature of human speech and the vulnerability of trying to talk about things we don't perfectly understand, the risk of making errors, of being misinterpreted. Aquinas' own biographers report that when he was writing something, he would often be in tears and would press his head against the tabernacle, a place in the Catholic tradition reserved for the Eucharist, and plead for understanding. But there is some good news in all this. The human struggle to speak can be a way to encounter God. And here we come back to the second important verse from John. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. The second person of the Trinity, the Word of the Father, entered human life and human language in the Incarnation. Christ brought about salvation by such a foolish and inefficient process that St. Paul called it the foolishness of speech or the foolishness of what was preached. This is an image of Jesus reading from the book of Isaiah in a Jewish synagogue. Can you imagine being the Word of God and having perfect knowledge of everything and condescending to walk into a place of worship and open a book and read somebody else's words about you? The struggle to give birth to our thoughts can be a participation in the mystery of the incarnation, our own kind of foolishness of speech. When we write or talk, we're not just floundering around looking for words beneath the judgmental gaze of an omniscient God. We're walking the path that the Word made flesh has walked before us. And this seemingly foolish inefficiency, this roundabout way of salvation, is the greatest expression of divine love. There's an invitation here to imitate Christ and to waste time in our search for and articulation of the truth. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.